We are looking at the great story of Queen Esther. And we've just come to the climax of the book. We're in chapter number 7. We're going to recap starting at verse number 1. Esther has invited Haman and the king to a special dinner. But Mordecai was still by the gate when Haman left the palace, and so he was really irritated by that and made plans to have him killed the next day and hung on a great big pole. But that all fell apart because overnight, God had brought some insomnia on the king, and the king ended up hearing again the record of Mordecai saving him from assassins. And because he hadn't been rewarded back at that time, the king decided that Mordecai should be rewarded now. And when he asked Haman's opinion as to how someone that the king wanted to honor should be honored, in a very vague sort of sense, Haman just assumed that it was about himself and really dressed it up nice. And then the king turned around and said, "Now, you go do that to Mordecai the Jew." So Haman started this day absolutely humiliated and went home and complained to his wife and his friends. And they basically said, "Oh man, if this is the way that things are going now, it's going to end badly for you." And boy, did they have that right. Because now he has to go to the dinner. Doesn't have a choice. The Secret Service escort, as I say, has shown up at his house to take him to this banquet. He can't skip town. It's impossible. And so chapter 7 says, "The king and Haman went in to feast with Queen Esther. And on the second day, as they were drinking wine after the feast, the king again said to Esther." Now, this second day, it's a little clumsy, I think, in the English. It's the idea that she had feasted them the day before. That's the first day. And now this is the second day. And this is all happening on our calendar at the end of June in 474 BC. So it's the 23rd day of the third month of the Jewish year. And so the whole idea is at this dinner, Esther's supposed to reveal her special request to the king. So he asks her, "What is your wish, Queen Esther? It shall be granted you. What's your request? Even to the half of my kingdom, it shall be fulfilled." Queen Esther answered, "If I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be granted to me for my wish, and my people for my request. So the thing that I'm going to ask you to intervene on my behalf for is save me and save my ethnic group. For we have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated." Now, I think that wording there would have grabbed Haman's attention. He might have been distracted by his previous experience that morning, but now he suddenly realizes, what? What's going on here? What is she talking about? Now she continues, "If we had been merely sold as slaves, men and women, I would have been silent, for our affliction is not to be compared with the loss of the king." So if it was just a matter of slavery, me becoming a slave, my ethnic groups becoming slaves, if that served the kingdom, then I guess that's just the way it would have to be. But since it's death and annihilation of my people, I can't remain silent. I have to speak up. And so King Ahasuerus said to Queen Esther, "Who is he? Where is he who dared to do this?" So who is the architect of this plot to kill you and all of your extended family, your ethnic group? And Esther made the big reveal. This is where Esther, the secret weapon, goes off. a foe and enemy, this wicked Haman. And then Haman was terrified before the king and queen. The moment it clicks with him that she is Jewish, he figures he's done for. There is nothing for him at this point. He has seen the tables well turned. And so the king arose in his wrath from the wine drinking and went into the palace garden. So he is so taken aback by the revelation that his own queen was being plotted against by his number one guy, that he feels he has to think about this. He has to process this for a moment. And so he goes out into the garden. Now, Haman stayed to beg for his life from Queen Esther, for he saw that harm was determined against him by the king. And the king returned from the palace garden to the place where they were drinking wine as Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was. So the king goes out for just a few moments. And Haman is like so overwhelmed with the desire to get himself saved, is he is down on his hands and knees, grabbing a hold of Queen Esther's physical presence. He's touching her, which under normal circumstances, that is like way outside of the cultural norms for a guy to touch a woman that he's not related to. But for a man to touch the queen is like way out of bounds. And so he is like way up all over her while she's laying on her reclining eating couch when the king comes back into the room. That's what he sees. He sees Haman pawing at the queen. And the king said, "Will he even assault the queen in my presence in my own house?" And as the word left the mouth of the king, they covered Haman's face. So the king blows up, and his bodyguard instantly acts because they know what he wants. He wants this to stop. And so they jump forward, they grab Haman, they restrain Haman, and they bag his head. He is being treated as the worst of criminals at this point. The king doesn't even want to see his face anymore. And then Harbona, one of the eunuchs in attendance on the king, said, and I love the fact that this guy was waiting for the right moment to reveal some information that he had. Moreover, the gallows, and once again, don't think wooden scaffolding with a hangman's noose. That's our modern Western idea, and even American Western idea. What's happening here is the Persian people, after they'd executed someone, would take their dead body and impale it on a great big tall pole, or maybe they would nail it to some sort of pole so that everybody can see this high example of what happens to criminals. This is a precursor of crucifixion. Eventually, the Greeks and the Romans fine-tuned it so that you did this to a person while they were still alive. So this guy reveals the gallows, or the execution, or the display pole that Haman has prepared for Mordecai, whose words saved the king. Notice that dig, that Mordecai was the king's savior, and Haman was building an execution place for him, is standing at Haman's house 50 cubits high, 75 feet. And the king said, "Hang him on it." And so they hanged Haman on the gallows that he'd prepared for Mordecai, and then the wrath of the king abated. So the king figures that Haman ought to die on his own. execution post. I wonder whether or not he had him executed first and then displayed his body, or if he just simply had him alive, impaled on the pole, or nailed to it. But that seems to start bringing the situation to a close. Except there's still a problem. Chapter number 8. On that day, King Ahasuerus gave to Queen Esther the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews. So his property now becomes part of the queen's property. Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had told what he was to her. So up to this point, the king didn't even realize that Mordecai, who had provided that information to save him earlier, several years ago, was his wife's adopted dad. So now he's finding out Mordecai's his father-in-law. And so the king took off his signet ring, which he had taken from Haman, and he gave it to Mordecai, and Esther set Mordecai over the house of Haman. So now everything's being turned around. Haman is now dead and gone. Mordecai is replacing Haman as the chief male advisor in the kingdom. And Queen Esther gives all the properties she just received over to him. So this house of Haman is now going to be Mordecai's house. Verse 3, then Esther spoke again to the king. She fell at his feet and wept and pleaded with him to avert the evil plan of Haman the Agagite and the plot that he had devised against the Jews. When the king held out the golden scepter to Esther, so apparently what's happened here is we've moved to another day, so that the king is in his throne room, and the queen, understanding that the danger is not yet past, comes in without an appointment. And so he holds out the golden scepter. Esther rose and stood before the king, and she said, "If it please the king, if I found favor in his sight, if the thing seems right before the king, and I'm pleasing in his eyes, let an order be written to revoke the letters devised by Haman the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, which he wrote to destroy the Jews who are in all the provinces of the king. For how can I bear to see the calamity that's coming to my people? How can I bear to see the destruction of my kindred? So she says, you've got to revoke the order. Now, King Ahasuerus said to Queen Esther and to Mordecai the Jew, behold, I've given Esther the house of Haman. They've hanged him on the gallows because he intended to lay hands on the Jews. But you may write as you please with regard to the Jews in the name of the king and seal it with the king's ring, for an edict written in the name of the king and sealed with the king's ring cannot be revoked. So now we come to the little problem. The original order was sealed by the king's signet ring, and it cannot be simply revoked. It remains in force because the laws of the Medes and the Persians cannot be broken. They cannot be revoked. But they can have a secondary order given to balance them out. So the king says, I'm going to give you the right to do the balance order. You write it out the way you and your father think is appropriate. And that's exactly what they do. The king's scribes were summoned on at that time on the in the third month, which is the month of Sivan, on the 23rd day. So that's where I was getting my calculations from earlier. So now we're talking about this being at the end of June in 474. And an edict was written according to all that Mordecai commanded concerning the Jews to the satraps and the governors, the officials of the provinces, from India to Ethiopia, 127 provinces, to each province in its own script, that's in its own lettering, and in to each people, in its own language, and also to the Jews in their script, in their language. So we've talked about this, that this is such a pan-ethnic empire, that every official edict is translated into all the different languages and then released at the exact same moment. And so it takes a little while to get that done. But here is what was written. He wrote in the name of King Ahasuerus and sealed it with the king's signet ring, and then he sent the letters by mounted couriers riding on swift horses that were used in the king's service, bred from the royal stud, saying that the king allowed the Jews who were in every city to gather and defend their lives, to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate any armed force of any people or province that might attack them, children and women included, and to plunder their goods. On one day throughout all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, on the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month Adar. So here's the balance. All Jews will be given express royal permission to defend themselves against any aggression on the day of the first order. And that they have royal permission to kill any of those people that come against them, even if they're officials of the government, and to take their stuff as booty, as plunder. So this secondary order basically balances out the original, and it puts a chilling effect on those that might have been looking forward to the Kill the Jew Day, because they were thinking, the more Jews I kill, the more goodies I get. But now that this order has been issued, it's like, wait, it's not going to be like shooting fish in a barrel. It's not going to be like killing sheep from the flock. It's going to be more like a war. And sometimes in war, you get killed. And I don't think I want to get killed. So the chilling effect is going to be a lot of the people will then decide, I'm not going to participate in this. Especially now that I know, think about this, now that I know that Queen Esther is Jewish. And Queen Esther is a favorite of King Xerxes. So for me to be pro-kill Jew means that I'm going to be on the outs with both the king and the queen. So there's going to be a lot of people that won't participate now. Unfortunately, there are an awful lot of other people that are willing to take the risk in order to annihilate some Jews and take their stuff. Now, back to the text. A copy of what was written was to be issued as a decree in every province, being publicly displayed to all the peoples, and the Jews were to be ready on that day to take vengeance on their enemies. And so the couriers mounted on their swift horses that were used in the king's service rode out hurriedly, urged by the king's command, and the decree was issued in Susa, the capital, or the citadel. Now, the Persians had an official courier system for messages, very similar in a lot of respects to what we Americans think about as the Pony Express, so that there were posts along well-maintained roads that kept these specially bred horses so that riders could ride in at a fast pace, switch to a fresh horse, and ride on. And this was over the entire empire. So that this order that's being released will be known within a few days, a week or so, all over the entire empire. And so the people start finding out real fast that the crisis for the Jewish people has been addressed successfully. So verse number 15, Mordecai went out from the presence of the king in royal robes of blue and white with a great golden crown and a robe of fine linen and purple, and the city of Susa shouted and rejoiced, and the Jews had light and gladness and joy and honor. And in every province and in every city, wherever the king's command and his edict reached, There was gladness and joy among the Jews, a feast and a holiday. And many from the peoples of the country declared themselves Jews, for fear of the Jews had fallen on them. So this actually is backfiring big time on Satan. He'd kind of hoped to get rid of the Jewish people as a whole in order to break God's promises to them. But instead, it's made Judaism clearly something of power and glory and something that you'd like to look into as maybe being a part of. So more people are now proselytizing to Judaism. Chapter number 9. Now, in the 12th month, now we jump forward to the actual day, which is the month Adar, on the 13th day of the same. So we are now February of 473 BC. When the king's command and edict were about to be carried out, on that very day when the enemies of the Jews hoped to gain mastery over them, the reverse occurred. The Jews gained mastery over those who hated them. Yay! You know, when the Jewish people read this story, usually in February, in late winter each year, they boo Haman, and they cheer Mordecai and Esther and the Jews winning. So I think that's a good way of looking at this. So the Jews gained mastery over those who hated them, and that's a good thing. That's a celebratory thing. And so the Jews gathered in their cities throughout all the provinces of King Ahasuerus to lay hands on those who sought their harm. Wouldn't that have been better if that had happened in Nazi Germany? If the Jews had won out against the Nazi fascists. Now, no one could stand against them, for the fear of them had fallen on all the peoples, and all the officials of the provinces and the satraps and the governors and the royal agents also helped the Jews, for fear of Mordecai had fallen on them. Well, he's number 2 in the kingdom now. Actually, number 3 after queen. For Mordecai was great in the king's house, and his fame spread throughout all the provinces, for the man Mordecai grew more and more powerful. The Jews struck all their enemies with the sword, killing and destroying them, and did as they pleased to those who hated them. In Susa the citadel itself, the Jews killed and destroyed 500 men. Now I'm shocked 500 guys thought that it was still a good idea, but they did. And they also killed Parshadatha and Dalfan and Asphatha and Porata and Adalia and Aradeta and Parmata and Arisai and Aridai and Varzathai, the 10 sons of Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the enemy of the Jews, but they laid no hand on that plunder. So apparently those guys went for broke, decided to try to kill Jews, and instead they ended up dead. But the Jewish people didn't take their stuff. They just let that go into the hands of the king. The very day the number of those killed in Susa the citadel was reported to the king, and the king said to Queen Esther, "In Susa the citadel, the Jews have killed and destroyed 500 men, and also the 10 sons of Haman. What then have they done in the rest of the king's provinces?" So he's like, wow, how many thousands, maybe tens of thousands of these anti-Semites have been tracked down and killed. "Now, what's your wish? It shall be granted you. What further is your request? It shall be fulfilled." And Esther said, "If it pleases the king, let the Jews who are in Susa be allowed tomorrow also to do according to this day's edict, and let the 10 sons of Haman be hanged on the gallows." So they're dead, so they're being impaled or hung up as a display. That's what's being requested here. So the king commanded this be done. A decree was issued in Susa, and the 10 sons of Haman were hanged. The Jews who were in Susa gathered also on the 14th day of the month of Adar, and they killed 300 men in Susa, but they laid no hands on the plunder. So they continued the next day because the anti-Semitism had not been eradicated. Killed 300 more that thought that they could take the Jews out. But again, they're not taking this plunder in. They're apparently letting that go to the royal treasury. Now, the rest of the Jews who were in the king's provinces also gathered to defend their lives. and got relief from their enemies and killed 75,000 of those who hated them, but laid no hands on the plunder. So now we've got the actual figure, 75,000. This was on the 13th day of the month of Adar. And on the 14th day, they rested and made that a day of feasting and gladness. So they celebrated their salvation and the deaths of their enemies. But the Jews who were in Susa gathered on the 13th day and on the 14th day, because you see, they had 2 days that they had to defend themselves. And then they rested on the 15th day, making that a day of feasting and gladness. And therefore, the Jews of the villages who live in the royal towns hold the 14th day of the month of Adar as a day for gladness and feasting, as a holiday, and as a day on which they send gifts of food to one another. So a little explanation as to why there's a little bit of difference in the celebration between those in the city and those in the country whenever the annual celebration of Dice Day comes around, Purim, the day of the lot. Well, we've run out of time for today and for this week. Have a blessed Lord's Day and weekend. See you in the new week.